again, everyone. Hope you are well, wherever you are, out walking the dog, running, driving the car, off to work, on the train, wherever you are. We hope the very best is going on in your game. And this week, we've got plenty going on in ours. Matt Christie, get a load of this. I mean, now we know the undercard for Usyk Fury, May the 18th. The week after that, you've got the rematch Taylor-Cattrall. Coming up in the next few weeks, you've got Haney Garcia. Yes, apparently. And then after that, a couple of weeks later, you've got Canelo against Munguia. There is a lot of shaking going on in the boxing world.
There's a lot to be getting our teeth into, isn't there, Alex? Yeah, there's been... I think it's been an interesting year so far. And an awful lot of it has been surrounded around interest about what's to come. Let's hope all of those fights you mentioned become reality. I'm getting a little bit edgy now as Haney and Garcia gets closer. So we're about to start the preview issue. You're thinking, do we really dedicate 12 or so pages to this fight and then have the mother of all headaches on Monday night when it's at last postponed? It's a difficult one, mate. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, you've got to commit, haven't you? But that could leave a gaping wound, a Vitali Klitschko-esque gaping wound in the magazine. Yes, I mean, it seems amazing. All that's been, well, apparently going on in Ryan Garcia's life, his social media profile, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, that, yes, full steam ahead. And I noted DAZN have got the running order for their kind of Haney Garcia preview build up as well over the course of the next few weeks. On this week's pod, we'll reflect on loads that's been going on. That Hitchens-Lemos controversy, I think it's fair to say, though, a good fight. Pacheco with another test early on in his career. Galal Yafai, Sky Nicholson in action there. This weekend, there's a Channel 5 York Hall bill, and then there's a big DAZN event up in Manchester as well. Gill against Zelfa. Jared Anderson, supposedly the next best thing among the heavyweights on the other side of the pond, is coming out in Texas this weekend as well. And we have, from this week in history, from 1992... we've got a fight that people in the business, even fans, probably will call a fun fight. And I think by that, they tend to mean, Matt, utter chaos and someone getting battered.
Yeah, I think when it's fun is when your expectations have quite happily been exceeded. When you were not expecting too much from it in the first place. And it turns out to be fun, as this particular fight does indeed.
Never tends to be fun for one of the participants. But yeah, in the far removed world of just simply watching boxing from a very, very distant position, this is probably what they call a fun fight. It's Julian Jackson against Ron Collins from 1992. That's coming up a bit later on. Let's touch on the news lines first of all. Usyk Fury, May 18th, undercard has taken its shape. Opetai against Bredis, rematch. That was a brief hiatus for Opetai, getting his title taken away from him and then getting to fight for it again. Interestingly, but that vacant IBF belt, that's a rematch, of course, from the fight that really launched the career of Opetai.
First fight was terrific, wasn't it? Where I think Opetai surprised an awful lot of us. What we have seen since then is that Opetai looks like a really serious operator, someone to get excited about. And the fact that he's been active, the fact that Bredis hasn't fought since then, I would say is not good news for the former champion. I fancy Opetai to do a good job, a better job, a more convincing job the second time round. But given that the first one was so exciting, I think you can say the rematch is welcome.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Opetai against Bredis. Kovalev back in action, apparently, on the undercard after a couple of years out off the ring, almost exactly, up against the Vegas resident, Swedish-born Robin Safer. I suppose people will just be wondering, is Kovalev doing a... They'll be calling it a Deontay Wilder now, filling his pockets while he can, or not?
We'll wait and see. I think Kovalev has not been the same fighter since the first Andre Ward fight, which was quite a long time ago. It feels like a long time ago now. I'll write briefly about that fight in this week's BN. But he's kind of been operating, in all honesty, on reputation alone, certainly for the last couple of years since the Canelo loss. He's had some out-of-the-ring problems. He's failed a drug test. Yet, I think the name Kovalev, for a certain type of fan, a certain age of fan, will still have that cult appeal. But I think, yeah, his best days are gone. But I'm sure people will be vaguely interested in that. And then you got Joe Cordina on there as well, haven't you? It's not the greatest undercard. But I think it's a perfectly serviceable undercard, given what the main event is. For me, you could put two or three fights on there, fighters I've never heard of, and I wouldn't care, as long as Usyk and Fury get in the ring and sort it out after all these years. That's what that event is about, and I think given the amount of money, even considering the money that they have over in Saudi Arabia to play with, I think given the amount of money that it's going to cost just to pay the main event fighters alone, I think they've done well to get an undercard like that, in all honesty. But surely everybody should just be pleased that at last we are getting that heavyweight contest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, quite a few of those Canelo undercards when he was with Golden Boy towards the tail end of their kind of relationship. A lot of those, the bases were loaded, weren't they? Or the purses were loaded up towards the top of the bill. Moses Otoma getting his chance on that undercard as well. And Cordina Kakachi, probably one of the best looking fights on the undercard, notwithstanding the main event itself. A bit of news, Matt, just featuring literally late last night. So we're recording on Wednesday morning, was coming through late on Tuesday night. And that was Willie Limond reportedly suffering from a seizure while driving. Now, we're still trying to get to the bottom of that, and more details are hopefully going to be forthcoming today, tomorrow. And I know you're trying to dig a little deeper, your end at Boxing News.
Yeah, we've got someone trying to find out more on that particular story. It's a really troubling development, in all honesty. Willie Limond, fantastic ambassador for British boxing, for Scottish boxing. He was due to have a fight next month, which was a surprise. We know that his son is on the circuit and an up-and-coming prospect. I think Willie Limond wanted one more. We don't know if the seizure was anything at all to do with his boxing career. I've seen some people suggest that that might be the case on social media. I wouldn't do anything other than take that with a pinch of salt at this stage. Our thoughts with Willie, we wish him all the very best, and we hope that he can get better. But as I say, it's quite depressing news, isn't it?
Yeah, fingers crossed for an upturn in that story. And I know you wanted to mention John Westgarth, who's passed away, big heavyweight from the Northeast.
Yeah, John Westgarth, former heavyweight, decent heavyweight. He actually knocked out Glenn McCrory when Glenn McCrory was 13-0 back in 1985. And I think that was the fight that convinced Glenn McCrory that perhaps his future didn't lie in the heavyweight division. He'd be better served down at cruiserweight. He went on to challenge for the European title, lost a split decision to Stefan Tangstad that hardcore fans will remember challenging IBF heavyweight champion Michael Spinks. He also lost another close decision to a future world champion, Anna Clay Wamba of France. He lost to Razor Ruddock, Derek Williams, Herbie Hyde, split two fights with James Iabola. He was a really good domestic level fighter. He was in the news more recently in deeply tragic circumstances when his son, Scott Westgarth, passed away after a fight. And yeah, our thoughts are with the Westgarth family at this exceptionally difficult time.
Yeah, amen. Amen to that. On a brighter note, I wanted to say hello to Dave Clark. We've been lucky enough to bump into some of our pod listeners and fans over the last few weeks. And Dave, who's a broadcaster himself, has done a bit of boxing broadcasting, often does greyhound tipping and commentary, etc. He's a big boxing fan of the pod, Matt. He went to the O2 the other week for Wardley against Clark. And it was really interesting speaking to Dave about that, because he was saying that all the chat where he was in the crowd, and, you know, they're like in Vegas at the MGM and so on, the T-Mobile, that those venues, you tend to have great seats one way or another. But if you are watching a boxing event from even from a good seat, you are slightly removed from the action compared to ringside, and then again TV. And it got me thinking how really there are almost three different fights going on at any one time. And Dave was saying from his seats at the O2, the feeling was that Wardley had won that fight, and all the chat in the pub afterwards was that Wardley had won the fight. And then when he watched it back, he was surprised to see the fight that he saw and realised it was much, much closer. In fact, you could have argued it the other way. And I'm sure from his position, from ringside, from watching TV, you've almost got three different fights unfolding, haven't you?
Yeah, it's interesting. And you mentioned that you wanted to talk about Dave Clark, but you didn't kind of allude to exactly what you wanted to say. And it's funny because I spent a little while last week writing an article about the whole experience of being ringside compared to somewhere else in the arena or even watching on the television, and I go into detail. And it's funny how your perception can be wildly different when you are at ringside compared to where you are somewhere else in the arena, and most certainly on television. I mean, we have seen from journalists, and I won't name them, but they have produce their reports for the newspapers that they represent, and they have favoured a fighter that practically nobody else who's watching on television would favour, and those reports have been derided as a consequence. It's really interesting, and I think it's something that not everybody is necessarily aware of when they are getting a little bit too high and mighty about a quote-unquote bad decision. And although I do believe that there are bad decisions, I think that unless you, and this is the difficulty, and this is what I've said before, unless you share that viewpoint of the judge in question, which nobody else does, let's be frank about that, it becomes quite difficult to argue against that point of view. Because you're seeing something completely different. They'll be seeing things that you're not privy to, and vice versa. But yeah, it's really interesting what Dave had to say there, because I do think that from what I've seen, the majority of people thought Frazier Clark nicked that fight, and the majority of people thought Frazier Clark controlled it. And he was, you could say he was unlucky as a consequence of the points that he lost, one from a point deduction, one from a knockdown, as to why he didn't win that fight. But yeah, I would say the vast majority of people that listen to this podcast have been to a fight. But if you haven't, it's certainly worthwhile going, because the experience is so different. You know, remember that guy, that friend of mine I told you about, who eventually got along to a fight a few weeks ago. He was just like, this is wild. So yeah, if you can, get along to them and, yeah, let us know what you think.
Yeah, that was Dan who went to the Heaney experience up in Brum. And I wonder, I think there was probably a lot of that involved in perhaps the judging of Richardson Hitchens against Gustavo Limos last weekend in Vegas. I think there was an element perhaps of that. I think there was also a big slice of two very contrasting styles. The front foot, relentless aggression of Lemos, and Hitchens maybe doing some clean work in and amongst all of the go-forward aggression. So I think there was a clash of styles at play that could lean towards a conflict of interest or just a difference of opinion in the scorecards. Ultimately, a close fight, 115, 113, twice on two of the three scorecards went to Hitchens, somewhat surprisingly to me, and I suspect probably to the bulk of the watching TV audience. Maybe the ringside judges, though, might have had a closer, more perceptive view of some of the work that Hitchens was doing up close, Mark. But there was probably quite a bit at play in that fight, and those watching on TV would have been surprised that Lemos didn't get the nod.
Yeah, there was a bit of a scream up, not a massive one, but I think it wasn't necessarily the fact that Hitchens got the decision necessarily that was quite so bothersome, as you allude to. There was one judge, Tim Cheatham, who scored that by 6 points to Richardson Hitchens, and you can, when you're watching a fight like that, struggle to comprehend how a judge can come to a scoreline as wide. Tim Cheatham as well, the week before, he gave Tim Zhu, didn't he? I think a 4 point advantage over Sebastian Fandora. And as is often the case with certain judges, they may have a couple of what is perceived to be questionable scorecards, and then they're all of a sudden public enemy number one in the boxing world for a little while. But Tim Cheatham has turned in some contentious scorecards over the years. It would be interesting to hear his viewpoint on that. As I say, it wasn't a decision in terms of Hitchens winning the fight that made me lose any sleep, I think. But that scoreline, particularly when you saw a fight like that where Lemos seemed to do really well, and I think it was another one of those where he exceeded expectation going in. He was the underdog. Vast majority of people thought Hitchens would win it and win it fairly comfortably. And all of a sudden, you've got the house fighter, as it were, the Eddie Hearn fighter, having a much tougher fight than anticipated. And I do wonder, I'm not saying it was the case here, because that would be condescending of me to say that, but I do wonder if subconsciously we favour the underdog when they are doing far better than they thought they would. But yeah, that 6 point advantage for Hitchens, I can't really see how he came to that scoreline, but I wasn't sat in his stall. I didn't have his viewpoint. I was watching on television. So, it's a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems unlikely. That's 9 rounds to 3. And I thought Lemos probably won the first three before Hitchens started to secure a bit of control through the next three. You might have had it level at halfway or close. But, I mean, Lemos nearly steamrolled him through the second half of the fight. I mean, he battered him in the eighth and he nearly steamrolled him down the stretch again and again and again. I think it's tough to take a defeat like that for Lemos, given the effort he put in. But there was a lot of huff and puff, in truth. It wasn't clean work. It wasn't particularly technical. But it did seem like he was landing punches. And it's you thought if there was a 115, 113 twice, it went the other way. But it didn't on the night. And that was supposed to be an eliminator for Subriel Matias's belt, Matt, the IBF. He's Puerto Rican, who's sparking everybody, isn't he? He's 20 knockouts and 20 wins, Matias. So theoretically, Hitchens steps forward towards him. But I watched this fight just wondering what Dalton Smith would have done, how he would have handled that fairly one-dimensional attack from Lemos. And I can't help but feel that Dalton Smith would have done a much, much better job. Maybe I'm being a bit unfair.
Possibly. It is that kind of unconventional swarming pressure that I'd imagine would be exceptionally difficult to deal with. You would favour Dalton Smith on just going on that evidence against either of those two fighters. But it's not always as simple as that. And I will say on that scorecard, if that had taken place in this country, and I think the reason why there was perhaps not such a noise about it, certainly not over in this side of the Atlantic, is that the fight took place in the middle of the night. Had that have taken place on a British bill, Robert Smith, he would have been sick to death of answering his phone and attempting to say, well, we're going to look into it. But you could guarantee that it would be looked into. And you do wonder if that is going to be the case over in Nevada with Tim Cheatham. One would hope so, because we certainly need a justification on that scoreline. Because, as I said again, from our point of view, 6 points for Hitchens in that fight is unfathomable. Yeah, Hitchens supposedly is now primed for a shot at the IBF title. I don't think we need to get too critical of Richardson Hitchens at this point. I think that it's one of those fights that good fighters can learn from. I would like to see an immediate rematch. I think that would be the best solution to all this. Give them a rematch. It's the least that Lemos deserves. And Hitchens, in a return, can show that he is capable of learning lessons. And at 17-0, Hitchens has shown that he's not quite ready for that top level. And I also think it's important to add that what I said last week, in that I more or less said all of these fights were set up as vehicles for the favourites, and I was wrong. It was a far tougher fight than that for Hitchens. I underrated Lemos, and he most certainly deserves, at the very least, a return.
And it was a far more difficult night for Diego Pacheco as well, wasn't it, against Sean McCalman, who brought in a lot of top-quality sparring experience, even though his in-ring education had been provided and earned on the regional circuit. But you can see why he'd be brought in for sparring for better fighters, because he brought that kind of sparring mentality, composure, Matt, to the night, didn't he? He always looked comfortable. He never really looked like he was ever doing quite enough, particularly through the second half of the fight when he was getting tired, McCalman. But he posed problems for Pacheco, and in truth, he made Pacheco look a bit one-dimensional, didn't he, for most of that fight. Pacheco did what a young buck, young prospect should do. He found a way to dig out a win, didn't he, while not looking particularly classy doing it.
He did what he had to do against a tough opponent. I think you could argue that Sean McCalman perhaps has got a little bit too comfortable in that sparring partner role against esteemed opposition, and you can see that kind of feed into their approach into fights. We've seen that with an awful lot of fighters in the past that are kind of fringes of a certain level, and then once they get that chance, they can't. It's almost like it's been ingrained into them what they're supposed to be doing in the ring. Pacheco, it's another learning fight for him. I've always been a little bit reluctant to shout his name from the rooftops as a future champion, and I think there's probably a reason why he is still fighting the likes. And no disrespect to Sean McCalman, but there's probably a reason why he is still fighting the likes of Sean McCalman, and he's not already in 12 rounders fighting renowned world-class opposition, is because that the people that are managing him, that are around him, that train him, know that although he has an awful lot of raw talent, he is a long way from the finished article. And I think that kind of fight, although he didn't set the world on fire, will only help him.
And it was interesting afterwards that Eddie Hearn was almost preaching slow down, it's no harm, he's only 23, maybe let's have another look. And yet Pacheco is, give me a top 10 opponent. And I was sort of looking through the international rankings, and you sort of think, well, who can that be really? Who can you? He's actually going to be quite tough to match. If he's to get what he wants, or more likely Matrimer to get what they want.
I think he needs more seasoning. I'd completely agree with Eddie Hearn. Eddie Hearn is no mug. He knows how to build fighters. He knows intelligent steps to take. He knows when a gamble is worth taking. And if he thought there was a gamble there that would take Pacheco to the next level, and earn a bucket load of cash, no doubt he'd take it. But I doubt that he can see one that he thinks is worth rolling the dice for at the moment with Diego Pacheco, particularly given how young Pacheco is. And if all of the pieces do start to fall together, he could be around for 10 years or so. I think with certain fighters, you do need to move quite steadily. And I think Pacheco is one of those fighters at the moment. But the thing is, with a boxer, they will always want to run before they can walk. They will always feel like that they are invincible. And that's the beauty and the fragility of a boxer, isn't it?
One gripe for the night. Now, it's obviously a thing for broadcasters to have current fighters who may be on their roster as part of the broadcast team, or just named fighters to be part of their broadcast, to hopefully add a bit of luster, a bit of their name shining on it in reflected glory, but also maybe, hopefully, to add something extra to the broadcast. Step forward, Clarissa Shields. When it came to the Diego Pacheco fight, said she'd never seen him. What she'd never seen him fight before. I mean, we live in a culture now where there are good people doing a lot of homework. More and more, who come to that job, whether it's in football, whether it's in rugby union, who are grafting and grafting and putting a lot of work into it. You just can't turn up ringside on the night and say you haven't even watched one of the fighters in the main events. But anyway, that's my private gripe out of the way. Galal won. Again, he's going to be in good fights, Galal, isn't he? But he is too easy to hit. I know he doesn't like the criticism, but he is too easy to hit. He's got to move his head. And it's not too late, is it, Matt?
I wouldn't have thought so. He's been matched fairly tough, in fairness to him.
Absolutely.
21-1, his opponent was going in. Again, it was a fight that the FI was expected to win, and he ultimately did win it. But he had a few problems along the way. I don't think it's too late for him to make a few tweaks, but an awful lot of what he does comes kind of effortlessly, kind of comes naturally to him. And that's not an easy ask for a fighter who has been boxing a certain way for an awfully long time. But this early into his professional education, you would think that improvements can most certainly be made.
Do you get the instinct, the hunch that they are going to push Galal, you find Sonny Edwards together sooner rather than later?
Yeah. It makes sense, doesn't it? And there's not an awful lot of fights that will generate that much attention down in those weight classes over in this country. And the longer that doesn't happen, the more likely it is that something will occur to prevent it from happening. So I wouldn't imagine it'll be the next fight, but I think it's something they can certainly build towards for later this year, early next. I wouldn't advise that is Galal Yafai's next fight by any means.
And last week, Eddie Hearn and Dalton Smith were more or less suggesting that Adam Azim had abdicated the European title to avoid fighting Dalton Smith. And there was a hint of that from Skye Nicholson last weekend when she comfortably outpointed Sarah Mahfoud, the same Mahfoud had only lost previously to Serrano. Serrano's title vacated because Serrano says she wants to fight 12 three-minute rounds. Skye Nicholson fighting for that vacant title and winning it, suggesting that maybe Serrano was using that as an excuse, and vacating the title means she doesn't have to face Skye Nicholson. I don't think Serrano is scared of any man or woman. And who knows whether Skye Nicholson's even on her radar with what she's done in her career so far and what she might yet hope to achieve down the final stretch.
There's no way that Serrano is running scared from Skye Nicholson. I thought Skye Nicholson was really impressive. I think she's been impressive during every step of her professional journey thus far. A decent opponent, an established opponent, But yeah, I think even if Amanda Serrano was watching that, she wouldn't necessarily be quaking in her boots. I think Skye Nicholson is a long way from the likes of Amanda Serrano. It's funny you mentioned Amanda Serrano. There's a lot of talk last week, wasn't there, about the potential for a Katie Taylor rematch in the Las Vegas Sphere. It would be the first boxing event to take place in the Las Vegas Sphere. But in order for that to happen, one would think, given everything that Serrano has been through to get to the point where she is now fighting 12-3, she would want a rematch with Katie Taylor to be 12-3s. And Katie Taylor is one of the female fighters who says, no, I'm quite happy fighting 10-2s, thank you very much. So I'd be really surprised if that was to happen. And how much of that is kind of hearsay, we wait and see. But yeah, there has been chats about that rematch. But yeah, back to this bill, I thought Skye Nicholson, she did everything that was asked of her against an opponent like Sarah Mahfood.
And speaking of Sonny Edwards as an opponent for Galal Yafai in the future, his brother Charlie's in action this weekend. Just very briefly, because it's on Friday, so you may well be listening to this later in the week. But Charlie Edwards up against Georges Jory, a French southpaw, 32-year-old, who's rebounded. They've got kind of similar, they're probably at the same stage of their careers, Edwards, you know, former world champion. That seems a long time ago, doesn't it? 2018, 2019, when he was beating good established names like Rosales and Moreno before he bumped into Julio Cesar Martinez. And in truth, he's never quite got his career back on track. He's fought on BT, he's been with MTK, then a Kieran Farrell bill, and now with Channel 5 and Wasserman. There's been a, you know, punctuated gaps between his fights as well, 18 months. A year plus, Matt, as well. So there's been a real lack of continuity. Where is Charlie Edwards at in his career? I suspect is what a lot of people are going to be wondering. Maybe they'll get to see this weekend.
He's talking a really good game. I mean, there's a really good interview with Sean Brown this week where Charlie kind of opens his heart to Sean a little bit, and he openly admits that his drinking kind of got out of control for a while. Didn't necessarily think that he was dependent upon it, but he was just drinking far too much. He was suffering from anxiety, and he just hasn't felt himself for a while. He says he feels fantastic now. He's split from Joe Gallagher. He's actually with Stephen Smith, the of the Smith Brothers fame. And he says he feels great and he can't wait to show everybody how good he is. I think it's still going to be, it's not an easy fight back for him, this one. You would fancy him to win. I mean, Edwards, as we know, tremendous talent on the way up. He argues that perhaps even though he won a world title, that those world title fights may have come too soon for him. But he's still just about young enough to have another run, I think, and I'll be really interested to see what he looks like on Friday night.
Little one Richards in action as well, I suppose, trying to get his career back on track as well, though he's still unbeaten, the tall southpaw. Remember when he beat Lennox Clark a few years ago? That seems a long time ago, doesn't it? Now, on Saturday in Manchester on DAZN, you've got Jordan Gill against Zelfa Barrett. This is a crackerjack of a fight, isn't it? Two fighters who have looked good, two fighters who've shown vulnerability. How much of that performance against Conlan last time up for Jordan Gill, how much of that was a taster, Matt, of what he's now capable of at this new weight? And does he need to step up again against a classy operator like Zelfa Barrett to outbox Rakimov a couple of years ago for long stretches of that fight until he was worn down and hurt late? Vulnerability, is that going to be an issue? Size, is that going to be an issue? Where they're at in their respective careers, both on the cusp of 30, does that factor in at all? There are lots of things at play in this one as well. What are the main talking points for you?
This is a fantastic domestic matchup, is what you would call a trade fight, I think. There's not going to be an awful lot of people out on the street who'll know who Zelfa Barrett is or Jordan Gill is, but in here, We know who they are. We know this is a really good matchup. There's an awful lot at stake here. One would could even suggest that for the loser, it's going to be a difficult road back. And I know that Gill has already proved to us that we don't take too much from a loss. We don't write people off from a loss. But I think at this stage, this will be a difficult one to come back from, particularly if either have got eyes on winning international titles. Jordan Gill spoke to Dec Taylor, said something what I thought was kind of bizarre but amusing. And he said because he spent so much time now with Ben Davies and previously he felt that he hadn't all the magic from Ben Davies and Lee Wiley, etc., hadn't quite worn off on him when he went in against Michael Conlon. Now he's had a full camp with them. He says this time I think I'll be between 36% and 45% better, roughly. So it's quite specific.
They do everything. They're big on data down there, aren't they?
Yeah. So I mean, I would imagine he'll be about maybe 39.5% better. And if he is, even at the bottom end of his estimation, even if he is 36% better than he was against Michael Conlon, I think Zelfa Barrett could have a really hard night.
Yeah, we're laughing, but actually, you know what he means, and you suspect there's probably a whole lot of truth in that, because in truth, we got almost a coming out performance against Conlon, didn't we? He hurt him and really went after him late on in that fight, although Conlon had kind of worked his way back into it as well. You sort of sensed in that fight that Conlon was kind of hurt and hanging on, and it was only a matter of time. But, you know, Gill looked bigger, better, stronger, didn't he, up at super featherweight? And, you know, maybe those body shots against Tonoko, 4 years ago, maybe the demolition at the hands of Kiko, you know, Kiko can do that to anyone. So, but maybe now Gill is just where he's supposed to be.
The only question mark for me around Jordan Gill is how eroded was Michael Conlon going into that fight? Was that the best of Michael Conlon that Jordan Gill took apart? If it was, then Zelfa Barrett has got a real challenge ahead of him in the Manchester Arena. But I think Jordan Gill is going to be so difficult to beat. Zelfa Barrett isn't easy to beat, but I think Jordan Gill, something now, what he has got inside his brain will be driving him forward. We've seen him come through some tough moments in the past. Zelfa Barrett is an underrated fighter. He comes from exceptional stock, as we know. But I just wonder if the momentum for this particular fight, which is so hard to call, is with Jordan Gill. I think the pick in the magazine is actually for Zelfa Barrett to win it. It really is a pick 'em kind of affair, isn't it?
Do you know the betting on this?
I don't actually. No, tell me.
What do you think?
I would say Zelfa Barrett is a narrow favourite off the top of my head.
Yeah, a bit wider. He is a bit wider than I thought. 4-9, so he's shorter than 2-1 on favourite. Zelfa Barrett, 7-4 about Jordan Gill. So just maybe slightly wider than you might have imagined in what could be a close fight. But if Gill doesn't hurt Zelfa early, Matt, if he doesn't land some of his big shots early on, and it's mad that we're now thinking that Gill might be the puncher in this fight when you look at his overall record, isn't it? Because, you know, what is it, 9 knockouts and 28 wins, something like that? And yet he looked like a real puncher against Conlon. Is that, as you suggest, does that say more about where Conlon was at coming into it on the back of a couple of really big, hard, heavy knockouts? Does it say more about that than it does about Gill's punching power? Or did it give us a glimpse into where Gill is now as a fighter and a puncher because he's now stronger and better up at super featherweight? So that's what people are going to have to ask themselves, because there is a kind of feeling, certainly for me, that coming into this, that Gill might be the puncher. And yet that might not be the case. And Zelfa might build up a head of steam and outbox him for a big, long passage of this fight, maybe all the way through. And he's a sharp punter himself, Zelfa Barrett.
He is. It's certainly feasible that is what transpires, in that Barrett is in control and he never relinquishes that control. He's looked okay since that fight with Rakhimov in 2022. I think he surprised a lot of people in that fight, including Rakhimov when he dropped him early, and then expended an awful lot of energy before being stopped himself in the ninth. But I think that proved for at least a few rounds that Barrett can cope at world class.
Let me put it this way, Matt, ask you this question. Had we not seen Gill against Michael Conlan, what price would Zelfa Barrett be then? Fives on?
Oh, yeah, 100%. But we have seen Gill against Michael Conlan. If this had been Gill's first fight back, yeah, you'd be lumping on Zelfa Barrett to win this fight, as a lot of people were probably lumping on Michael Conlan to beat Gill not so long ago. But Gill has got that result in his locker. He has felt that euphoria from resisting rock bottom and feeling that joy of victory and proving people wrong and proving to himself that he's got what it takes. And I think once you have been that low and you have bounced back from it, I think it's going to take a real effort from Barrett to contain that. That might be my heart speaking as opposed to my head. I think if you were to break down their various styles, that you can make a really convincing case that Barrett wins this probably on points or even grinds him down late. But I think Gill has got something inside him that might just see him to victory in a really tough fight.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think Zelfa will outbox him. I think Zelfa's just, on what we've seen up to date, I think Zelfa's just better, just classier. And I think he probably outboxes him. But if Gill's performance last time against Conlan, if that gave us just a taster and the extra 36 to 45% is forthcoming, well, now we've got one hell of a fight, haven't we? And we did get a teaser, no doubt about that. On the undercards, anything else catch your eye? Scottney, Rian Dixon are in action in their respective world title fights?
They're both going to be favourites, I think. I think Carbajal has been there, has been in and around it, hasn't she? I like Ellie Scottney an awful lot. I think, in all honesty, the fight I'm looking forward to on the undercard the most is Michael Gomez Jr. versus Cain Baker. Cain Baker, his record may lead you to automatically pick Michael Gomez Jr. to win it. Cain Baker 19-10-2 compared to Michael Gomez Jr. at 20-1. It's for the English title. And I think I would favour Michael Gomez Jr. to win it. But I think Cain Baker will certainly make his presence felt. And I think for as long as that lasts, that's going to be a real fan pleaser.
Yeah, I think you're right to pick that one out on the undercard. Hopefully we get to enjoy that. And just briefly, Saturday in the US, you'll be able to see this courtesy of this guy's link up with Top Rank, won't you? Jared Anderson against Riyad Mehri. Is that a slight step down from his last two fights? Maybe not. I mean, Mehri had a good result against Yoka, didn't he? Just squeaking past the French Olympian. But Anderson, I think he's been well matched, Matt, isn't he? I think they're getting the matchmaking right with him. Hard enough tests, and he's come through this, particularly that Charles Martin fight a couple of fights ago. That was a really good learning curve fight for Anderson. Whether he's the stuff remains to be seen. But I think they're making the right moves with him.
I've seen a lot of educated voices kind of predict great things for Jared Anderson. He's certainly got everything required to be a really good heavyweight. Far too soon to say, in my opinion, if he has got the mental fortitude, and the extra little ingredients that need to be sprinkled over the physical gifts to actually make it to the very top in the heavyweight division. I can understand why they've made this fight. I think the marketeers would argue that it's a step up, given that Mary did just beat Tony Yoker, an Olympic gold medalist, but that was Yoker's third consecutive points defeat. And one is left wondering about Tony Yoker, and who could you possibly match Tony Yoker with where you'd pick him to win at a certain level. Mary is also, he's a career cruiserweight. He's only recently been operating at heavyweight. So this would be a massive upset if Anderson was to come unstuck here. It's not a mismatch. It's a perfectly feasible and understandable bit of matchmaking. And I think Anderson will win again. And I don't think he'll have the problems that he had against someone like a Charles Martin. And I suspect that he will probably manage to get the stoppage this time.
That's coming up this weekend. Coming up next, it's This Week. This Week in History, we go back to 1992, the 10th of April in the former Bullring in Mexico City. Really, it was a Don King, Julio Cesar Chavez vehicle for a big night with lots of fans going to see Chavez, who would win and defend his lightweight title for the seventh time to move to 79-0. But on this fight night, the fight we're concentrating on is Julian Jackson against Ron Collins. Julian Jackson, the explosive, hard-punching middleweight Matt, who was on an extraordinary run of 36 knockouts over the course of a decade. Unbelievable. And of course, he will have sprung to many European and British boxing fans' attention a couple of years previously, when behind, cut, getting the worst of it in the early rounds against Harold Graham, came back with that wicked hook to win the title.
And he followed that with two quick knockout wins. And I think as Ferdy Pacheco said, that both Dennis Milton and Ismael Negron kind of went into their fights with Julian Jackson well aware of Jackson's reputation and fought like they were just in there to survive. Consequently got knocked out very quickly. Dennis Milton last 2 minutes and 10 seconds and Negron lasted 50 seconds. And all the talk going into this fight with Ron Collins was that can Ron Collins even get out the first round? Listening to the commentary, I thought they were quite kind to Ron Collins' reputation. My memory is that Collins wasn't really a well or highly regarded middleweight at the time going into this fight. Okay, he was 21-1, but that one loss, which had come just two fights before, which was a 10-round decision loss to Gilbert Baptiste, decent fighter, but kind of over the hill at that point. And he'd lost to Gilbert Baptiste in 1990. He'd had one fight in the interim, Sean McCrory, who was 8-5, for a bit of context on what Sean McCrory was like. And then he's going straight in with Julian Jackson. Julian Jackson was a massive favourite going into this fight. But the ace up his sleeve, perhaps, was that he'd shared an awful lot of sparring rounds with Julian Jackson. So that what Milton and Negron were afraid of, he knew that he'd already stood up to, at least to a certain degree. So he went in there with an awful lot of ambition. And as a consequence, he surprised a lot of people, didn't he?
And I love the start, Matt. It reminded me a bit of Ali against Foreman, Rumble in the Jungle, where Ali almost charges across to try and land a big right hand just to let Foreman know that he's in the fight, that he's not intimidated. And there was an element of that with Ron Collins. As you said, the previous two first round knockout victims to Julian Jackson, including Ismael Negron, that was a middleweight record at the time, that knockout by Julian Jackson. Ron Collins, trying to make a statement, ran across to the centre of the ring and he landed a huge left hand. The very first actions of the fight, Ron Collins trying to put a flag and a marker down in the middle of the ring just to say, I'm here, I'm not intimidated, I'm at least going to have a go.
He did as well, and one judge actually gave him that first round, and I think you could argue he won that. He was wobbled ever so slightly, I think, with about 10 seconds remaining. But otherwise, you could say that Ron Collins probably edged it, given that what he landed. Collins was a southpaw, but he was a southpaw who favoured his right hand, so he was a converted southpaw. Jackson, at times, is exposed as a little bit kamikaze-like during this fight. And very often, as is very often the case with punches of Julian Jackson's quality, of their prowess, they can forget to do the basics when they know full well that if they land flush with either hand, their opponent is more than likely going to sleep. And I think we saw a bit of that with Julian Jackson at certain points during this fight. Never really looked like it was going to be an upset. Let's be frank about it. But there were some flashes of concern for Julian Jackson, particularly, I think, in the fourth round, because Jackson had had a big third. And then Collins came back. You got Collins's corner screaming at Ron on the stool, saying, he's effing tired. He's ready for the taking. Effing go after him. And Collins then comes out, and on the scorecards of all three judges, he wins the fourth. And Jackson admitted afterwards, because Collins was talking to him frequently throughout the fight, and Jackson admitted afterwards, because Collins was taunting him and saying that he was going to run out of gas, that Jackson altered his own approach to ensure that that wasn't the case.
Well, I wondered about that, because the pace dropped so markedly at the end of the third, probably because Jackson had gone after Collins. They were trading hooks. Collins was hurt, but he was also fighting back, showing great attitude, as he had done in the first and second rounds. And then with the pace dropping in the end of the third, going into the fourth, I just put gassed question mark next to Jackson's name. Was it a deliberate ploy? Was he taking his time, or was he knackered? And as you say from the post-fight interview, it sounds like it was a deliberate ploy. But if you were watching that live at the time, I suspect you weren't quite sure. And there's all that talking from Collins. You can hear it through the fourth round. The jab's working well. He's shouting, come on, come on. You get all of it. There's a late flurry from Collins. It's his biggest round of the fight, and yet it doesn't matter. Because having effectively taken the fourth round off, Jackson cranks through the gears in the fifth.
Yeah, he really does. And when he's in full flow and when those punches are landing flush, you can see how much Jackson was enjoying it. You can see how effective those punches are and how pronounced the power is. When Jackson catches a fighter and he catches them in the sweet spot, their whole body almost freezes. Their legs straighten to the point that the only option really, if they attempt to move, is to fall over. We saw it with Dennis Milton when Dennis Milton was kind of iced at 2 minutes and 10 seconds of the first round, where his whole body just goes straight and rigid. And it was the case here. There was a really nice short explosive left hook in the fifth that caused Collins to go back. Jackson knew that had done the business. You could tell he almost congratulates himself mid-flight and then flies in and lands a straight right hand, and Collins goes down, and that's the end of it. I was looking for an interview that Jack Hirsch conducted with Julian Jackson, because I remember him saying something quite peculiar as an explanation for his power. And Julian Jackson said to Jack Hirsch, this is a few years ago now, that my punching power was because of my timing and accuracy. I worked on speed, and as a teenager, I used to lift pots of fish. That is what increased my power. All we need to do then is just go and find some pots of fish. We'll lift them up a few times. We'll be able to hit like Julian Jackson. But there's more to it than that. I think an awful lot of it. Punches, I think, are born. I really believe punches like Julian Jackson are born. You either have it or you don't. I think you can work on certain techniques to make the punch more effective. But I think ultimately if you are now at a standing start and you want to grow up to be a puncher like Julian Jackson, I don't think there's any exercises or drills or techniques that would make you that puncher unless it's already within you. I've always believed that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And you get a sense of that with Collins. It's just the sheer weight of Shaw. Ultimately, it just wears him down, doesn't it? There's just, it's an element of exhaustion against the ropes. A couple of those big right hands and they're too heavy, it's too much. And ultimately, he is stopped in that fifth round. And it's another knockout victory for Julian Jackson, who coming into this one, Matt, 43 wins, one loss. That was to Mike McCallum 6 years previously. So what a record he had coming into this fight. 43-1, 41 knockouts in those 43 wins. And all by knockout over the course of the last decade. I mean, an extraordinary hard-punching resume coming into this one at a time where, of course, you had James Toney, also long-reigning IBF middleweight champion as well, Matt, who would fight the same weekend. He would beat Glenn Wolf over this same weekend, and he'd have a rematch with Mike McCallum a couple of months later as well, who he'd beat again. Eran Barkley just round the corner. Doug DeWitt, of course, who Nigel Benn would face, just round the corner. So James Toney was one of the other champions at this time and was one of the names that Don King and Julian Jackson mentioned after the fight.
Yeah, at the time, it was a fight that I really wanted to see, James Toney against Julian Jackson. I think with hindsight, you'd pick James Toney. But Toney had his issues with certain fighters. I remember that particular one that you mentioned there, the Glenn Wolf. He didn't look great in every fight, but I think against someone like Julian Jackson, James Toney would bring his A game. And I think that Toney would ultimately prove too intelligent for Julian Jackson. You could argue that Jackson was a little bit unfortunate not to get a fight like that, but then you could also say that he did. He got to fight Mike McCallum when he was on the way up, and he had a good first round. Then Mike McCallum taught him a bit of a lesson in the second, and then not long after this fight, he ran into Gerald McClellan, didn't he?
Do you know, I watched that fight back. That is a great fight. I've popped it down in the diary. Interestingly, both the first and second fights happen the same week in history, coincidentally. So Gerald McClellan 1 and 2, Julian Jackson, Gerald McClellan 1 and 2, both happen in the same week in history in different years. So we might be able to dovetail them. But the first fight, which comes up the year after this one, that is a great fight. Ultimately, it's McClellan who wins it in 5, having hurt Jackson early on in that fight. But Jackson comes storming back and McClellan looks in a bit of bother, actually. And there's a head clash. Jackson gets cut, and that seems to change the complexion of that fight. And ultimately, it's McClellan who wins it with a huge knockout. But that's 5 rounds of really competitive action. And on balance, you'd say Jackson was probably just on his way to winning that fight before the head clash. So that, I think that's an interesting one, Matt. We should feature that. The rematch is an absolute blowout. McClellan goes after him, hits him hard, hurts him early, and then gets him out of there inside a round. But their first fight is a cracker.
Yeah, we'll definitely go into more detail on that one. The first fight was one of the fights of the year, and the rematch was more than welcome going in. So you can look at the results on paper and draw the wrong conclusion, but the first fight was exceptionally competitive.
But after this night in history, you know, I think McClellan won's probably Julian Jackson's last big hurrah. After this night, he loses 5 of his next 16, and all of those losses come by way of knockout. They often say that, don't they? But the big punchers often end up being vulnerable themselves, and that was certainly the case for Jackson down the stretch in his career. Final words on this, Matt. Big night in the former Mexican bull ring. Chavez defending his title again against the unbeaten Angel Hernandez, who came into this one looking to get Chavez's WBC title. It was Chavez who won that by fifth round stoppage.
Yeah, it was a it was another Chavez Carnival, this particular bill, wasn't it? A Don King special. It wasn't loaded like some of the Don King bills at this particular time, but there was an upset, wasn't there, there with Edwin Rosario losing his WBA super lightweight title. Rosario, just one of my old cult classic favourites, who was generally in the kind of fights where he'd either score a knockout or be knocked out, and he was on the wrong end of one on this night.
Yeah, he was. Akinobu Hironaka, it was, who beat him in a round. Yes, we'll have a Rosario fight. And Tony Tucker, who'd only lost to Mike Tyson around this time, hadn't he? Tony Tucker, he was on the bill as well. This night from April 1992. Go back and watch and enjoy that. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter as well, at Opening Bell Pod. That's at Opening Bell Pod. You can get us on Twitter, on X. And we will speak to you again next week. Enjoy the fights. Go well.